Shrink Wrap Radio number 351, exploring the placebo response with Jungian analyst Dr. Richard Creighton.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Richard Creighton, MD, and we'll be discussing the role of the placebo response in healing generally and psychotherapy specifically. Richard Creighton, MD, is a research immunologist, Jungian analyst, former research director of the Harvard Medical School Mind-Body Medical Institute, and author of The Placebo Response. He is an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and teaches at Pacifica Graduate Institute. Dr. Creighton is also the author of numerous books, including The Placebo Response and The Power of Unconscious Healing. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Richard Creighton, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. I was fortunate to be able to watch the Jung Platform's video of your presentation in Salt Lake City. And so I'm really excited to speak with you about the placebo response and to share you with my listeners. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, perhaps you can take us through your very diverse academic and clinical background, because it's really quite a background that you have.
Well, as you said, that's kind of a long story, so I'll try to abbreviate it. I'm trained as a medical internist as well as a pathologist. I then trained as a pulmonologist and as a psychoanalyst, both in Freudian technique and as a Jungian analyst.
Wow.
So I see patients both in the medical world and the psychoanalytical world, and I see a fair number of patients with psychosomatic disorders.
Okay, and have you been a researcher as well? Because, you know, your writing about the placebo effect certainly is about research. I wonder if you've also been on the front line of doing the research or more of a student of the research.
Well, I've done both, I think. I started out my research career actually as an immunologist and did work in a variety of areas of cancer immunology and psychoneuroimmunology. And I've also done work on the physiology of meditation.
Oh, interesting.
As well as on the placebo response. So I've kind of had a very varied and wide scope career.
Boy, I will say that you have, and I think we're of about the same age and have some similar interests. In fact, my doctoral dissertation at the University of Michigan was in part about meditation. It was the role of attention in hypnosis, hypnotic susceptibility, and meditation. So it's been very exciting to meet all the groundbreaking brain research now on meditation.
Yeah. Yeah, I was involved with some studies, again, looking at Tibetan Buddhist meditators and looking at the changes that occurred, both in their systemic physiology and in their neurophysiology by fMRI scanning.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. Were you working with Richie Davidson by any chance?
No, I know Richie Davidson, but we weren't working together. I was actually working with Herb Benson in Boston.
Oh, yes, okay. Well, at what point did you get interested in becoming a Jungian analyst?
Oh, I'd say it's probably around 25 years ago. I think, like many, many people, I read Jung as a college student, found him interesting, and pretty much left it at that, and then rediscovered him maybe in the late 80s.
Okay.
In part through my interest in myth and the series that Joseph Campbell did on PBS.
Yes.
And, I had been training actually as a Freudian psychoanalyst, and at the completion of that training decided that I would like to continue on and see what Jung had to say.
That's fascinating. I'm not sure how many people have really been on both sides of the fence in that way.
Well, I think Jung was on both sides of the fence, and I guess
that's a good point.
Yeah. Freud was as well, and I find them actually to be quite complementary. So I think it's quite important at some level to be have some basis in both forms of thinking.
Yeah, I've actually interviewed a lot of Jungians. What was it about Jungian psychology that particularly called to you? You mentioned the Joseph Campbell series. Anything else that sort of particularly was calling to you?
I think, again, the interest in symbols, Jung's understanding and application of symbols to the interpretation of images, the idea that images are the containers for affect, which I think is a very important observation, mm-hmm. As well as the importance of myth in both in the psyche and in how it plays out collectively in society. I think there's lots of application to the Jungian way of thinking. And again, it's really not a new way of thinking. He was quite right in seeing that it had its roots in alchemy and Kabbalah. But it's certainly a continuation and a scientific sophistication of that type of thinking.
Yes. So how did you become interested in the placebo response?
Well, again, I was working as a research director at the Mind-Body Medical Institute, and that had been an area of interest at that institute for some years. And it was about the time that the NIH was actually putting out a what they call an RFA. They were looking for applications to do research in the placebo response. So I began to sit down and really review the literature, and I got lost in it because it's kind of a large sea of muddle in many respects, and much of what's written about it is of interest, but never really addresses precisely what appears to be happening with the placebo response.
Well, that was the impression I got from the presentation you gave that I watched. Was before watching it, I thought I sort of knew what the placebo response was, but I had no idea that there are so many complexities attendant to it. For our listeners, how do you define the placebo response?
Oh, I guess the best way to define it would be that it is an innate capacity of the human mind-body to promote a healing response, and that it is in part almost certainly based both on the capacity for that response to occur, but also cultivated or in part inhibited by early developmental events.
Okay. Yes, one of the things that interested me was that you point out that the body has a number of mechanisms that tend toward healing, and that the placebo response is just one of those. And I never thought of it in that way before, in that context.
Yeah, I think that's true. And again, like the other systems, for the most part, these are what we would term unconscious or implicit responses, so that one doesn't consciously will oneself to have a placebo response. It essentially happens within the context of a situation. And that situation appears to be related to the interaction between a caregiver and a patient. And it can occur both in the doctor's office, or it can occur in between two friends, or anywhere where individuals are seeking some sort of physical or psychological help.
Yes. And most of us think we know what a placebo is. I said I thought I did. But you say we really don't. What are you getting at there?
Well, I think the only way to really define a placebo is that substance or that procedure, a chemical, a pill, whatever, that evokes a placebo response. So the placebo itself can be virtually anything. It can be a surgery. It can be a alternative complementary mode of practice. It can even be psychotherapy. And there's an interesting overlap between psychotherapy and placebo, because many of the same elements that evoke placebo responses in your medical physician's office are the same elements that are generally applied by trained psychotherapists in psychotherapy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Now, for a lot of people, placebo has had a negative connotation, with people saying something along the lines of, well, that's just a placebo. What's that about?
Well, that's an interesting historical development, and one of the things I trace in the book that I wrote on this topic is exactly how some of these ideas about placebo have changed. Essentially, prior to medical science, all healing was essentially mediated via placebo responses and placebo effects. It began to take on a pejorative connotation with the Enlightenment and with the age of reason and science, where it became, I think, problematic for scientists to explain why people would necessarily be responding to something that didn't appear to have any effect in and of itself. So it took on, again, this negative connotation. It got lumped in with quackery and other forms of medical charlatanism. And for a long time, really, and even today, I think, has a negative sense for many physicians. Yes. Largely because they can't really explain what's going on or even predict when placebo responses are going to happen.
Yeah, it seems to me that the placebo response should be considered a very positive thing. However, instead of physicians being able to capitalize on it, I believe you reported that it's actually illegal for them to deliberately and knowingly provide a placebo treatment unbeknownst to the patient. What are your thoughts about that, pro and con? I can see arguments, you know, both ways.
I don't know that it's illegal, but it is considered widely unethical to knowingly give someone a placebo. Now, again, having said that, as I discuss in my text, placebos are given all the time because even when we use a known effective drug for a purpose for which it hasn't been proven to be effective, that essentially puts it potentially in the category of a placebo. So we're constantly using placebos in medicine, and it's only when one focuses in on the ethics of it that it becomes problematic for some individuals.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really grabbed my attention, because sometimes I have achy knees and I've wondered if I need arthroscopic surgery or not, and you report that there was a time when it was legal to make surgical incisions without actually doing the arthroscopic process, and people reported that they felt better, that their knee pains went away at the same level of frequency as people who had actually received the procedure. Do I have that right?
You do, and that was actually a fairly recent study, but there have been a number of studies of that type. As you suggested, they're harder to do these days because understandably, the human studies committees in hospitals frown on those types of approaches, but occasionally they still happen. And I think that the fascinating thing about these studies is that all of these approaches, in the minds of the individuals, both the doctors and the patients, make perfectly good sense. I mean, they're truly rational procedures. It would make sense that if you've got a joint fragment somewhere in your knee and you're having pain, that removing that would relieve the pain. And in fact, it does, but it happens even if you don't remove it, if you just make the incision and do a sham surgery. So the fascinating aspect of placebos is that they sometimes seem to make a tremendous amount of good sense, but it doesn't mean that they're not ultimately going to be placebos.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they can't be proven to be effective when looked at in a scientific manner.
What about the use of double-blind random-controlled trials to rule out placebo effects? That's something that you discuss, and you kind of refer to it as the so-called gold standard.
Well, that is true. The way in which human medical therapeutics evolved was that essentially for many years, most information was what we term anecdotal. So physicians would treat a patient, notice a response, and then communicate with other physicians. But there was no scientific way, if you will, of determining what was truly effective therapy versus what potentially was what we're calling today a placebo. So the test that was devised by a statistician and a pharmacologist, actually, was this so-called randomized controlled trial where one group was to receive a drug or a surgery that was touted to be effective. Another group was going to get a control, and then they would be essentially compared. And what was important about it was that the two groups be randomized, that is, there would be no bias in the selection of the two groups, and that neither the clinician or the person who was being treated knew which they were getting, whether they were getting the drug versus the placebo. And then after the trial is completed, then a code is broken and one actually can see which group got which. So in that respect, one can begin to, again, scientifically define what are placebo effects, because there you know that the individual has not received a drug or a procedure that's likely to be effective, and yet you're seeing effects.
And, of course, you know, I learned about that in graduate school, and most of us have, and that's kind of, as you say, has been the gold standard. But you point out that there are some limitations to that approach, that it's pretty hard to control for what is a placebo or what is not a placebo.
Well, unfortunately, it's an imperfect world. And I think when we started the interview and you asked me how I got involved with this field, I told you that I got involved because there was an interest in placebo research. But ultimately, I think what really fascinated me was, you know, what we call epistemology, and that is how we indeed know what we think we know.
Mm-hmm.
And this really applies in the area of medical therapeutics. The fact is, it's very, very difficult for a large number of interventions, be they drugs or surgeries, really be certain that what you're doing is effective. And so in the actual development of the randomized controlled trial, one needs to be very clear that the groups are indeed randomized and that no one in the group knows or can guess more than half the time which of the interventions they're getting. It turns out when these things are studied, there's often a large skew in what both patients or subjects and relatives, nurses, doctors know about the trial. So they can often guess fairly accurately whether they're getting a placebo or the actual drug. That skewing means that the trial is no longer truly randomized and the results are biased, and therefore really can't be used as a gold standard type of test.
Yeah, one of the things that you point out about that is that if the, and I forget what the exact language for this is, but if the placebo is kind of inert, that is, there's no detectable experience, then people pretty much will assume, oh, I'm in the control group. But if they detect any kind of a physiological or psychological change that seems to be a consequence of the procedure, then they say, "Oh, I'm in the group that's getting the active treatment."
Yeah,
so you have to go to some pains to give people a placebo that in fact is going to do something to them.
Right, and this is a concept termed, as you suggested, an active placebo. So it needs to produce some sort of physiological sensation that can be perceived by the subject so that they don't come away with the sense that, you know, I haven't received anything at all. And it turns out when one does use active placebos that the placebo response rates in groups go up substantially.
Yeah, and I gather that a lot of the past research, maybe even current research, I don't know, doesn't take care to or hasn't taken care to give an active placebo. Is that right?
That is true. And again, there are a variety of reasons for that. And some of them, again, are discussed in my book, and others have written about it as well. And they probably have mostly to do with the financial concerns of the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
For which placebo responses are really problematic, because the higher a placebo response, the more difficult it is to prove that the drug that's being tested is effective.
So in other words, it's in their financial interest to have it not to not have a placebo effect.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I'm not making any comments positively or negatively about capitalism here. it's just that is indeed the case. And you know, these drug trials are extremely expensive. They're huge investments for the pharmaceutical industry. So if anything, they are always looking for ways to exclude placebo responders and placebo responses.
Yeah, this is a topic, too, that's come up in other interviews around psychotherapy and comparing one psychotherapeutic approach to another, and the APA and people of that ilk, they want to have controlled studies before people can assert that something is effective. And yet, as you point out, it's tremendously expensive to do that. So a lot of these sort of lesser known complementary approaches, if you will, they don't have the budget to come up with the research that could demonstrate efficacy.
That's true. There is a center here in Boston that's basically devoted to complementary medicine and placebo research, actually, that has studied a fairly large number of alternative complementary techniques. And essentially what they've found, and they've studied them fairly rigorously, and virtually all of them, they found that they work essentially through the placebo response.
Okay, and you do go out on a limb and you say evidence-based medicine is a myth. How so?
Well, I think it is a myth. I think science itself is a myth. You know, essentially, I think one of the contributions that Jung made was to recognize that virtually everything in our psychological sphere represents at some level a myth. The evidence in evidence-based medicine is often not that good. And anybody who doubts that need only read the newspaper or magazine or watch the television and see how many different studies have looked at the benefits or negative effects of drinking wine or exercise or estrogens. Again, the evidence that you have is only as good as the studies, and the studies themselves are very difficult to reproduce. These are not the types of research that go on in physics laboratories or chemistry laboratories, where you can very much control the conditions and repeat the experiment numerous times. Clinical trial essentially happens once. And if you try to repeat it, you know, in a similar way a month later, you may get a very different response.
Yeah. In fact, one problem you point out is that random controlled trials do not predict the efficacy of a placebo for any given individual.
Now, that's absolutely right. Your listeners need to understand that all of the statistical approaches that we have in medicine, which are indeed valuable, always look at large groups of individuals, and they really say nothing about what might be occurring for any given individual in a testing group. So at the individual level, you know, we're totally agnostic as a result of these studies.
Yeah, and not just for placebos, but for things that supposedly are solidly established, but they're solidly established for a large statistical group.
That's true. I mean, there certainly are drugs and procedures that are clearly effective. You know, we give people anesthesia all the time, and we're almost 100% confident they're going to go to sleep in the operating room. Most antibiotics, I think, have shown overwhelmingly to be effective. But there's a whole series of drugs that we use in the armamentarium, which at best have borderline types of efficacies. And those are the groups of drugs which are, I think, clearly problematic with respect to placebo controls.
You say that we're immersed in the myth of science, and I certainly get that. It made me wonder, though, what about folks who are these days who are immersed in the myth of anti-science, if you will?
Well, you know, I think it's problematic to get too identified with any myth. And that's not, again, not to realize that, that myths are not important. I'm not suggesting they're imaginary, but again, they are just that. They are metaphors for large systems of thought. And so to get adamant about one myth versus another is an argument that really goes nowhere and can't really be shown to be effective.
Yeah. Now, given that you've found that surgery can be a placebo, I would think that would complicate the decision for any given individual who's been told that they need surgery or something. I mean, it raises a question in my mind. I'm thinking about surgery differently.
Sure.
After hearing what you have to say.
Well, again, there are surgeries, I think, that are unquestionably effective. You know, if you've got a leaky heart valve and your cardiac surgeon replaces it, that surgery certainly works. And you can look at the physiological effects of that almost immediately. The surgeries that are problematic are those types of procedures that are applied to chronic ailments which don't have necessarily very, very high efficacy rates. So the one that comes to mind, we already talked about the surgery for arthroplasty for knee pain, but the one that really comes to mind are surgeries for lower back pain, which mm-hmm. are fairly common. And yet, if you look at the surgical success rates, they're really not very high or necessarily predictable. And that's an area where I think people need to be very cautious about pursuing surgical approaches until they've exhausted all other means of non-invasive interventions.
You know, another example that you gave was tonsillectomy, which I guess maybe that's an example of maybe fads in medical science. I certainly had my tonsils out as a child, and it was kind of routine.
As did I. And I don't know if you recall, you may be of the same vintage, having your feet radiated.
I used to get in that machine and you could look through it and see the bones in your feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody ever, they were a wonderful, weird green. And well, I wondered, where did those go?
exactly as you said. I mean, there are fads that come in and out of medical practice. And, you know, at the time, they're thought to be either effective or certainly not harmful. But I had my tonsils out as well, as did many people over 50. And, 20 years later, it became the overwhelming idea that you needed the immune cells in your tonsils to help prevent infections in the head and neck. So, you know, thinking changes. When I first came to the hospital that I practice at now, there was a surgeon who was an elderly surgeon at the time who was doing total colectomies for constipation. It worked, but you wouldn't find many people who would do that procedure today. Wow. Hysterectomies were done for the disorder that used to be termed hysteria. There were a lot of procedures that were done surgically, a lot of them actually directed at women. For maladies that probably had no rationale.
Yes. I want my tonsils back.
Good luck.
And so how about in psychotherapy? I think you said earlier that pretty much all psychotherapy has a strong placebo basis.
I think there is clearly an element of placebo effect in psychotherapy, and if you've practiced psychotherapy or been a patient in psychotherapy, I think most of us are aware that individuals who come in with some degree of anguish often will feel considerably better after one or two sessions. Now, it doesn't mean that their psychological issues have been cured by any means, but there is this immediate sense of having been in the presence of another person that promotes well-being. And I think that's the type of placebo effect that we're talking about. And that's mediated just by the proximity to someone who you potentially trust or you feel that can help you. The fact that someone is paying attention to you and listening to you. These are all the underlying elements that constitute the so-called art of medicine or art of therapy, which are really important neurobiological cues between individuals that promote these types of responses.
If psychotherapy is all pretty much placebo, why are you a Jungian?
Well, I didn't want to leave you with the impression that psychotherapy is merely a placebo.
Okay.
I think psychotherapy has the capacity to evoke placebo responses, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of other things that need to be done in psychotherapy or that need to be done in medicine. The important piece here is to recognize that it's not an either or with a placebo response. So if you're a patient and you come to me with tonsillitis, and I give you an antibiotic for your strep throat, well, there's going to be the piece of that response that is directly to the antibiotic, but somewhere in that total response is a placebo effect. And it's very difficult to tease that out. But the placebo effect happens, again, automatically, and it doesn't matter whether you're giving a non-effective intervention or an effective intervention. If the context is correct, there are going to be placebo responses around it.
Yeah. It caused me to wonder, why not license non-professionals who are naturally gifted, who score very high on such things as listening, empathizing, caring, etc.? I mean, we've all met people in the, quotes, real world who have those qualities.
Yes. Well, you know, my feeling about both medicine and certainly psychotherapy is that it's largely not something that one learns in school, and that there are people who either due to natural innate abilities or through their own life experience are better suited for therapeutic interventions than others. It would be great, I think, in many respects, to select for those people in all of the healing arts. Unfortunately, that's not the case, certainly not in the people who are selected to practice medicine, and even to a large extent for the people who train to do psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes, in the past at least, I felt like maybe I got overeducated and that was a little bit harder to be as spontaneous and real as I was before getting so educated.
Well, I think the goal, as you probably realize, it's like playing a musical instrument. You practice, you practice, you practice, and you do the drills, and then eventually you reach a point where there's some fundamental shift where you can begin to do these things more spontaneously and out of a place of creativity.
Yes, that's a great analogy. I like that. It reminds me of one of my colleagues was a ranked tennis player, and he said, oh, he saw me serving. He said, oh, let me show you how to improve your serve. So he showed me something, and my serve went all to hell. I couldn't serve for some time. But if you keep at it, then it reconsolidates at some point and at a somewhat higher level than you started. The bad habits have to fall away first, I think, before something good can emerge.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Certainly, alternative and complementary medicine are relevant in this discussion, and you've mentioned an institute in Boston that you've worked with. What's the name of that institute?
It was called the Harvard Institute for Alternative and Complementary Medicine. I think it's now termed the Placebo Institute. It's changed names recently.
Did you have any effect in that happening?
Not primarily, but no. The people there were quite interested in placebo responses, so that's how it occurred.
Yeah. So what are the psychological factors that contribute to the placebo response?
Well, again, I think we've already touched on a few of them, but I'm glad to reiterate them. I think one of the reasons that alternative and complementary approaches are generally good at evoking placebo responses has something to do with both the context of how treatments are delivered and the amount of time that the practitioner spends with the individual. Mm-hmm. So the average medical visit in both the United States and Great Britain is somewhere between 6 and 8 minutes, which isn't a lot of time to listen to an individual's complaints and spend some time discussing them.
Yeah.
You know, the average time spent with one's acupuncturist, may be considerably more.
Right.
And so there is the sense that one is being attended to, and this type of attention, again, tends to evoke placebo reactions.
That's a good feeling. You know, I've been sometimes skeptical of alternative complementary approaches. Actually, I was seeing an acupuncturist for a while recently, and just being listened to in that way and being touched, and I did feel cared for, and that really does make an impact. You also talk about other contextual factors like a big pill or a pill of a certain color or a use of injections as kind of conveying the message of this is big medicine, this is powerful medicine.
Exactly. You know, I think there have been a number of phenomenological studies like that, interestingly, that have looked at placebo responses based on modes of injection size and color of pills, et cetera. And it just speaks to the psychological factors that feed into the expectations that we learn that play a role in placebo responses. So it's just a general sense that a larger pill must, in a naive way, have more medicine or stronger medicine, that injectables are stronger medicine than medicines that one takes by mouth, that certain colors in pills tend to be more excitatory, others more placid in their ability to evoke psychological reactions. And so all of these things are factors, and they're factors that the pharmaceutical company is well aware of. They take these things into consideration when they manufacture a pill, its size, its shape, its color, the name. All of these things are important.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me that they study the color and the kind of color implications of what the pill is supposed to do and the psychological responses to color. And that shouldn't have surprised me. It did surprise me. It should not have surprised me because I actually do work in market research consulting. And I know that they do that with everything else, with packaging and package design and so on. So, you know,
absolutely.
Why not pill color?
Yeah, they've gone as far as to put people in the fMRI machines to look at their neural reactions to certain elements in their products. So, they're very sophisticated.
Yes, yes. You even went into some of the neuroscience of the placebo and areas of the brain that light up, speaking of fMRI and so on. And you tie it into secure attachment dynamics during infancy and self-soothing. I thought that was a really interesting discussion. Maybe you can take us through that a bit.
Well, again, if you think about what the sine qua non, what the real essence of the placebo response is, it's that sense of well-being that takes place. There may or may not be a substantial physical response, but everybody who's had a placebo response feels better as a result of it. So you need to, again, just knowing how neurobiology works, begin to consider that these systems that will be involved in those types of reactions are going to be the hedonic systems, those systems that tend to promote well-being or feelings of well-being. And it turns out that if you look at what happens in the neurobiology or neurophysiological reactions to placebos in those that have been studied, they're very, very similar, both in terms of the structures and in terms of the neurochemicals that appear to be involved with those that occur during the development of well-being and soothing during the infant maternal caretaking interaction, which makes sense. So that in some respects, the placebo response is the reactivation, if you will, of those systems that were learned early on in childhood and then get re-evoked and remembered, if you will, again, in response to a caretaker situation as an adult.
And another factor that you mentioned that surprised me at first was affiliation seeking as a response to stress. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's fascinating, and I think it's also expected. One of the things that distinguishes mammals from other forms of animal life is that mammals are social beings, social animals. And so there is a tendency to affiliate as part of the mammalian evolutionary tradition, if you will. So when one is in a situation where one is feeling unwell, one of the first things that takes place is an attempt to seek out caretaking behavior from another. That's why we go to doctors. Prior to that, we went to shamans and all the way back into the pre-dawn of history. But that type of interaction is built in to the mammalian system and by itself probably plays an important role in evoking these primitive responses.
You talk about revisioning the placebo response. In what way do we need to revision it?
I think one of the things, as we've already talked about, is that the placebo response has become largely within medical science something that's been devalued and something that's looked on in a somewhat pejorative way or as some mode of superstition. The most striking thing to me and the most troubling and disappointing thing to me, frankly, is that so little research has been done or so little monies have been directed at doing the research to look at how these systems work. Because I think if we had a better idea as to how placebo responses work, we'd have a great deal more to say about the science of well-being.
Okay. And you also talk about something called the nocebo, which I gather is a person is given a placebo, but instead of getting better, they get worse.
Yes. That's, again, a fascinating area. And in my own research, I've linked it, I think, to a common event that one encounters in psychotherapy and that Freud actually described. Which is the negative therapeutic reaction, which is that there are some individuals who, in the face of receiving care that should be taken in as beneficial, tend to reject it. And the same group of people actually turn out to be the nocebo responders in medical trials. And I talk about in the book the so-called structuring of the psyche of these individuals. They tend to fall into the old terminology of borderline structuring of one's psychology, so that there really is an overlap between nocebo responders and people who respond negatively in psychotherapies.
And I would think there might be a tie-in with attachment theory as well, that these would maybe be people who are poorly or ambivalently attached.
Exactly. And that is precisely what you do see. For the avoidant attachment individuals, you also see, as you see in the obsessional individual, substantial degrees of anhedonia, which, as you might imagine, preclude the ability, if you will, of developing placebo responses. So there is an important link between early attachment and the type of attachment, either optimal or dysfunctional, and the ability to eventually or later on in life develop placebo responses.
Mm-hmm. You know, you pointed out that one characteristic of the placebo response is that it occurs in conjunction with human interaction. And that made me wonder if there might be something along the lines of a negative placebo. For example, I'm sure you've heard the expression of a toxic person, or mm-hmm. if certain interactions can activate healing, I'm wondering if others might activate illness.
Well, I think there's an old Chinese proverb that goes something like the right medicine given by the wrong person, you know, is of no benefit. And so that's, I think, absolutely true. And you certainly see this in practice all the time. There are individuals who are, as you mentioned, born healers and are good at handling their patient populations, and other individuals who are offering the same thing next door, but the results are not as good. And so the idea of the physician or the psychologist or the nurse as the placebo themselves is an important feature, and that's been studied, actually, in some detail.
Yeah, actually, that's reminded me of, and I'm blocking on his name, but a famous, well-known psychotherapy researcher who has said that one of the reasons why the efficacy of psychotherapy hasn't fared as well and has fared at the same level as the placebo in some studies is that they don't subtract out the people who are actually making people worse.
Well, it's true. All you need to do is practice psychotherapy and have people who've come to you after seeing several other people before to hear those types of stories. So, yes, unfortunately, licensure doesn't really necessarily account for efficacy.
Well, I've run out of ammunition here. I wonder if there are any final thoughts that you'd like to share, or any stone that I failed to turn over where you'd like to make a point.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for having read my text, I guess, fairly carefully, because I think you touched on most of what I also would agree were the important aspects of what at least I wanted to talk about today with respect to the placebo. So my compliments to you for picking up on them, and I think we probably covered the whole field.
Okay, well, that's great. I will refer people to your book. And Dr. Richard Creighton, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Okay, thank you, Dave.
Wow. What an incredible mix of training and background experience Dr. Richard Creighton has. Research immunologist, Freudian psychoanalyst, Jungian analyst, former research director of the Harvard Medical School Mind-Body Medical Institute, not to mention his experience studying Tibetan meditators using fMRI imaging. I feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to have this conversation with such an accomplished professional. I think the word shamanism came up only once in our discussion. However, in a Salt Lake City video presentation that I watched, it came up quite a bit more. In the past, there have been a few listeners who have taken me to task for asserting that the roots of psychotherapy are more shamanistic than scientific, and that the practice of psychotherapy, in fact, has quite a bit in common with shamanism. From the discussion that you've heard here about the placebo response, it shouldn't be too hard for you to extrapolate to my conclusions about the relationship between psychotherapy and shamanism. By the way, if you're interested in shamanism and perhaps relatively new to Shrink Wrap Radio, then you might be interested in some of my past interviews on that topic. I would recommend to you number 199, The Secret History of Dreaming with Robert Moss, number 170, From Dream Body to World Work with Arnold Mendel, number 168, An International Conference on Shamanism, number 153, Medicine Dance, A Shamanic Journey with Marcia Scarborough, number 43, A Jungian Shaman with Carl Greer, Number 31, Shamanic Psychology with Alberto Villoldo, PhD. Number 7, Mayan Shamanic Healing. And number 2, Dreams and the Hero's Journey with Dr. David Gordon. Moreover, if you'll go to our Shrink Wrap Radio website, you'll find a link where you can purchase an entire course on the placebo response through our strategic partner, the Jung Platform. And that course includes 3.5 hours of Dr. Creighton on DVD video, a study guide, 3 continuing education units through the Jung Platform, an online forum, and a teleconference with Dr. Richard Creighton, and finally, a certificate of completion. It's a really excellent opportunity, and you'll be able to get a 10% discount using the secret word Dr. Dave, which is spelled D-R-D-A-V-E, and it can be either all lowercase or uppercase. So look for that link on the site. You can also use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar to order his excellent book, The Placebo Response and the Power of Unconscious Healing.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Claire Edwards from the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, Australia here. I work as a facilitator and coach specializing in neuroleadership and positive psychology. Dr. Dave and your Shrink Wrap Radio form an integral part of my continued professional development. Being based in Australia, it's so convenient for me just to download the podcast and listen at a time convenient to me. I also really enjoy the breadth of experts and the wide range of opinions, which helps me form my own conclusions. Dr. Dave, thanks again for providing such a valuable, insightful, and value-added service.
Thank you for that, Claire Edwards. I really appreciate your support and hope others will feel inspired to follow your example. Well, I'm still pretty much in catch-up mode after my trip to New York City. However, since I'm working about 3 weeks ahead, I should be caught up by the time you hear this. By the way, if you enjoyed today's interview with Dr. Richard Creighton, you might be interested in signing up for the online video course through our partner, the Jung Platform. You'll find a link to the Jung Platform in the right-hand sidebar on our site. Just click on that and scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page for the May/June special. And that's with Dr. Creighton. And don't forget that you can save 10% by using the discount code of Dr. Dave, which is just D-R-D-A-V-E. Unfortunately, there are no new transcripts to announce. We always have an ongoing need for transcriptionists. So if you'd like to make that sort of contribution, please drop me an email indicating which episode you would like to transcribe. If you go to the transcriptions page on our site, you'll be able to see which ones have not been transcribed as of yet. And also, you'll see that some are marked in red with the words transcription needed. Those marked in red are ones where someone previously had volunteered to transcribe the episode, but then for some reason or other did not follow through. So it would be nice to get those cleared up. Personally, I find having transcripts for these episodes very useful, especially when I'm putting together collections of shows for continuing education units. I would think that the transcripts would also be especially valuable for students. Finally, I really want to thank you for being a Shrink Wrap Radio listener. Please help spread the word to bring others into the fold, and I'll do my best to continue to surprise you with abundant and varied content.
Hi, this is Andy Matzner, psychotherapist, author, and tarot reader, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Andy Matzner, who I am happy to announce will be my guest on our next episode. More about that in a bit. Hey, I'm starting to wonder if I'm the only one who says tarot instead of tarot. Is it just us who are at Sonoma State University or what? I think most of the people that I met at that conference in New York were saying tarot. But then, since when did New York pronunciation become the guide to perfect speech? just kidding, all of you New Yorkers out there. Let's take a quick dip into the old mailbag. First, we hear from Greg, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. Greetings from New York City. I'm a mental health counseling graduate student and devout fan of your show!" Exclamation mark. And I say, "Yay!" And he goes on to say, "I discovered your podcast about a year ago, and I've been hooked ever since. The wide array of topics covered always keeps my interest and inevitably turns me on to new ideas in the field. Just a quick bio about myself. I'm finishing up my graduate degree in MHC, which I think stands for Mental Health Counseling, and I have been interning for almost a year at a sexual addiction clinic called New York Pathways. Perhaps I'm mistaken, but I do not believe the topic of sexual addiction / sexual compulsivity has been discussed. I feel this particular addiction, although not formally recognized as an addiction yet by the DSM, will be an exploding and formidable challenge for couples, families, and mental health practitioners in the coming years. Timothy S. Lee, the owner of New York Pathways, is an LCSW who has specialized in the treatment of sexual addiction for over 6 years. He's an engaging and articulate man, and I feel his unique slant on this topic would be of interest to your listeners." And so he goes on to give me contact information. And finally, he concludes, "Thank you, and I look forward to listening to more of your stellar interviews in the future. Warmest regards," and that's from Gregory in New York City. Gregory, thanks so much for, it's always wonderful and uplifting to me right now as I reread this to learn of another fan or even addict, if I may build on your letter here. So I'm really glad that that you've been able to get a lot of inspiration from the show. And I have added Dr. Lee to my long and ever-growing list of possible guests. I agree that this would be a good topic. I don't think I've done very much on sexuality per se. So, yeah, that could be coming down the line. So keep listening. Next, we hear from John, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is John, and I wanted to say that I really, really have enjoyed listening to your podcast over the past 6 months, which is when I first discovered it. I'm a psychiatrist newly out of residency and am very interested in health, nutrition, lifestyle, etc., as they relate to mental health. So I really enjoyed your podcast with Dr. Hedaya. I have been seeking consultation from Dr. Scott Shannon, who I think is of Dr. Hedaya's caliber and wisdom when it comes to whole or holistic psychiatry. I think he would be another good person to interview on this topic. He's written 2 books. One is titled Please Don't Label My Child, and he's also written Handbook for Complementary and Alternative Therapies in Mental Health. He also has a center he started, and he puts the URL here, which is www.wholeness.com/Scott_Shannon.php. He goes on to say, "Also, I have been participating in a Jung study group and am doing my own Jungian analysis and thus have been really enjoying all the Jungian analysts you have been interviewing, especially Monica Wickman. So keep those coming." Great. I appreciate that encouragement. He goes on to say, "One final suggestion, as if you need more. As a budding psychotherapist, I have been struggling to bridge the gap between behaviorism, psychodynamic psychotherapy, and spirituality." He puts in parentheses, "I trained in dialectical behavior therapy during residency." Close paren. "I listened to your interview entitled Behaviorism and Spirituality and found it left me with more questions, so I would love it if you could find other folks to interview about this topic. Thanks again for all your energy and efforts. Regards," and it's signed John. I should say Dr. John. "P.S. I also really appreciated your podcast with Steve Mertzel. I used to regularly engage in the big mind, big heart process though had tapered off my participation prior to the sex scandal and always had mixed feelings about it when I found out. Parentheses, we're all human, but he also held the trust of so many people, close paren, and it was really helpful to hear him speak about his experience. And once again, that's from Dr. John in Seattle, Washington. And John, it's always great to hear from a fellow mental health professional, a psychiatrist at that, and someone who's going to be a Jungian analyst probably before too much longer. And it sounds like we share similar interests. You've tapped into and mentioned some of the same things here that are of interest to me. You know, I will add your suggestions to my long and growing list, as I said previously. And I appreciated your comments about the interview with Roshi Mertzel, because that was kind of a revelation to me as well, and something that I kind of had to wrestle with myself as to, you know, what kind of stance I would take regarding the interview here. Okay, wonderful to hear from folks. So with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. So as always, send your emails to me to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, which people have done. I invite you all to go back and kind of take a look every now and then. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where I am ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my answer phone at 206-350-9918. So thanks again to Jungian analyst and researcher Dr. Richard Creighton for expanding our understanding of the placebo response. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will feature Andrew Metzner, a psychotherapist who on occasion uses tarot, in his work with clients. He has also written a new book titled The Tarot Activity Book. And I should also mention that in his clinical practice, he has specialized in working with transgendered people. We had a delightful conversation that I think you'll enjoy listening in on. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Listening to Dr.